Last weekend, we heard the sad news of the death of legendary broadcaster Brian Matthew. So for the next hour, we look back over his illustrious career, from his days on the Light programme presenting Saturday Club and Easy Beat, to his 27 years at the helm of Sounds of the 60s.
I've compared many programmes, I've DJed many shows, I've played the hits and misses, I've seen the way it goes. My girlfriend likes the job I do, it grips her heart and soul. But now she's found a substitute instead of rock and roll. Cause she's gone trad mad, trad mad, the latest music craze. The way she raves and jives about just leaves me in a daze. She used to love old Elvis P, she found him big and tall. But now she loves the trumpet that's blown by Kenny Ball.
Yes, that was Brian Matthew, pop singer. His own contribution to the sounds of the 60s he knew and loved so well. I'm Jim Moyer, and having been in charge of Radio 2 through some of Brian's greatest days, I'm here to pay tribute to his unique contribution to popular broadcasting and to honour his memory. I must be careful not to call him one of the jewels in the crown of Radio 2, because the first time he was called that, he was immediately fired, and he never forgot it. It was all part of the ups and downs of the Brian Matthew story.
Good morning, Avid. We'll begin this week with a hit by Motown star Marvin Gaye.
I was already a fan of the voice. You know, that wonderful, smooth, lovely radio voice of Brian's, which hasn't changed at all. And to actually go and meet him and be part of these programmes was a thrill for me, yeah.
There are certain people that come into our business blessed with lovely voices, people like Richard Burton, Catherine Hepburn, Brian Johnston, for instance. He had a terrific voice. But Brian had a wonderful voice, absolutely perfect for radio. It's a very warm voice, and that's my first recollection. He came across in such a warm, friendly way.
And the wonderful thing about Brian, he did have a couple of health scares, and they sounded serious, and they indeed were serious some of the time. But he came back and sounded younger than ever every time. It was brilliant. Lovely to hear him.
Helen Shapiro, John Layton, and some bloke called Bruce. And we'll hear from all of them again later. It's all true. Brian's was a magnificent voice, quite unlike any other in broadcasting. It was a big, wide-open instrument, trained for stage work, but always used confidentially. And in terms of accent? Hard to place. The home counties are in there somewhere, and yet Brian was brought up in Coventry.
I don't think I ever had a Coventry accent. I mean, some experts might tell you there's a trace of it there, but I don't know. I was always conscious of speaking better than that, because it's a pretty horrid accent. It's like Birmingham, and I don't care for that a lot, but Coventry's, if anything, worse.
Sorry, Coventry, but the Matthew family certainly made it up to you by joining in fully with the life of the city.
My father at that time conducted a brass band. He'd been a conductor of the Salvation Army band, but then there was, so often happened, I won't get into that, but there were all sorts of fallouts with the army and the musicians, and several of this band moved over to the then Coventry Silver Band, and Dad went as the musical director of that.
All very placid until the Second World War started. Coventry, famously, was one of the cities selected by the Luftwaffe for special treatment, as BBC Radio's Scrapbook for 1940 recalled.
400 bombers concentrate a greater weight of bombs on Coventry in one night than on a similar area of London so far.
When dawn comes, the survivors emerge to hear a desolate voice echoing amid ruins they can scarcely recognise.
First of all, I want to remind you about how very important it is that all water shall be boiled before being used in Coventry.
Among those dealing with the chaos and destruction of that terrible night was Brian's dad.
He worked in Morris Motors at that time, and he was also in the auxiliary fire service, and he'd been out one of the blitz nights for 14 hours anchored to a two-man on his own to a two-man hose, and he couldn't see. I mean, I was going in to see if there was any school left, and he was coming home, and we met. His eyes were absolutely red like fire, and he got home, and so my mother told me afterwards, fell on the floor and just lay there for hours and hours until he recovered. Yes, it came home to me that way, I must admit, really forcibly.
Brian was evacuated smartish to the beautiful cathedral city of Lincoln.
Then after a number of months, they said, well, we think it's all right now, you can all go home for a weekend, and thereupon was the second Coventry Blitz. So we went to Lincoln for nothing, I think, really, because the only nasty bits came when we were on holiday.
So where does poor Fargo in the blackout? He stays home and glares at the kids. He grumbles at mother, she grumbles at him, and says, well, go out, I'm not keeping you in. So father goes out in the blackout, although it is pouring with rain. And just as he gets out, then off goes the siren, so he comes right home again.
My own mum, bless her, used to put us in what we called a glory hole, a sort of cubby hole under the stairs. Or, alternatively, we could sit under the dining room table, which I did with my old gran, who lived with us all my life, really, my father's mother. And she would sing wonderful old songs, wonderful hymns all the time. The Blitz was going on. Moody and Sankey, or Sankey and Moody, whichever way round it was. Terrible old hymns, really, for the most part. But that was her contribution to the well-being of one and all, sitting under a table.
But Gran wasn't the only music maker to be heard in the Matthew home.
He had a wonderful, enormous collection of records, my dad did, which I listened to. He never, ever tried to force anything on me, so that my collection started up with big bands and jazz and a certain amount of pop, I suppose. And he was just absolutely OK with all this.
He even tolerated Brian's early efforts on the jazz trombone.
Half a dozen of us used to congregate in the Memorial Park in Coventry, which was where lads went to meet up with girls from the other schools there. And we used to play so loud you could be heard about 2 miles away.
Music was now a serious matter for Brian. He had a good ear and he used it.
Also, funnily enough, a lot of tenor sax players appealed to me too, like Coleman Hawkins. Eventually, when we lived where we are now, I got to a stage where I had to have a tenor sax, so I bought one of those. And the guy at Boozy said, who are your favourites? And I said, well, Coleman Hawkins. He said, oh, that's pretty old-fashioned. It nearly hurt me, that. I thought he was the greatest ever. Well, he was pretty good.
Coleman Hawkins never had to join the army, but Brian did. He was called up to the Ordnance Corps, where he learned to type. Very useful for scripts.
So that was great, but at the end of about a year of that, they transferred me over to the military side, to the unit's headquarters, where I was took over as the quartermaster sergeant. I was only a corporal, but they called me the quartermaster sergeant for about 6 months. And then, to my horror, because I got used to that, and it was a good way of life, and I had a girlfriend in a local pub and went to a drama department in the council was running, and I thought, wow, this couldn't be better, really, while I'm stuck with this life. And then suddenly, out of the blue, notification came that I was being sent to Germany.
It doesn't sound like a blessing in disguise, but it was.
Off I went to Germany, and after 3 months in an ordnance depot over there at a huge area called Bielefeld, I thought, no, the thing to do over here is to get into this Forces radio caper, which I hear all the time, and I'm sure I could manage that. So I applied for an audition, which they gave me, and they said, oh yeah, good, yeah, we'd like you on Join Us Here. And I didn't hear anything then for about 6 months, and this was due to the dilatory behaviour of the staff at the camp where I was based. They just couldn't be bothered to get on with it.
Well, finally, Brian complained to the Brigadier and was moved the very next day to a new life entirely.
We wore civilian clothes, we lived in a hotel, we did all our broadcasting in what had been the famous Hamburg concert rooms, with facilities like out of this world, really. All BBC equipment had been shipped over and fed into these studios. They had marvellous orchestras and bands that were built in, like when we had our own concert orchestra, dance band, jazz groups, everything there. And they were all German personnel. And it was just a marvellous life. One did everything in radio format there, you could imagine. There were some quite illustrious people. Raymond Baxter was our head of announcers. Cliff Mitchellmore was the head of variety. And several other people who listeners would probably remember were broadcasters alongside me. Jimmy Kingsby, no longer with us, he was the chief announcer for a while.
Out of all this, it was drama that now appealed to Brian most. He took a week's leave, flew to London and auditioned for the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and he was accepted. The Berlin airlift got in the way briefly, but then Brian was demobbed.
I was whizzed over, got me demob suit and terrible hat, and went straight down to RADA. An uncle down there found me some accommodation, so everything kind of fell into place.
RADA in those days was definitely posh. John Gielgud had trained there briefly, and his voice was the ideal of those times.
This England never did, nor never shall, lie at the proud foot of a conqueror, but when it first did help to wound itself. Now these her princes are come home again, come the three corners of the world in arms, and we shall shock them. Naught shall make us rue, if England to itself do rest but true.
What was it Sir Alec Guinness called those tones? A silver trumpet muffled in silk, I think. And socially too, though this was about to change, RADA was a bit toffee-nosed, in a not quite serious way. Brian disapproved.
Sadly, one of its failings, in my view, in those days was that it used to take a lot of girls from wealthy families whose parents saw it as a sort of finishing school. You're not really going to do it, are you, seriously, dear? You know, then you can, yes, you can go there for 2 years and enjoy yourself and then come home to mummy. And a lot of them did.
Brian put in his 2 years' training, and then his triumphant progress continued. He became an Old Vic player. Another posh gig. The union, Actors Equity, made sure that they didn't only take young people from the Old Vic's own school.
So you must please go and take a dozen people from RADA to balance the books a bit, and they will have to be paid the minimum wage, of course. Horrendous to think about now. That was £4.10 a week. Can you imagine living on that?
And off they went in Henry V and Captain Brassband's conversion.
We did a little tour in that. And at the same time, my wife, she wasn't my wife then, but she was in another part of the company touring round with the two one-act plays. And they were down at Brighton. And anyway, we did a piece together, obviously, because we were going to get married then. And we thought, well, we don't want to be split up, because that's what goes wrong with a lot of marriages in the theatre. If you can't work together, you don't usually stay together. We went to live with my mother and father, because it was cheaper to survive for a while. And I took a job over there as a milkman, which was exciting, wasn't it? But it was all I could get. I tried, first of all, in my multi-language capacity, of getting a job with Jaguar, because they were quite impressed with the fact that I could natter away in French, German, Dutch, and that's about it. But that was quite... they hadn't got many people who could do that.
Ah, there's a thing. Not many people knew about Brian's prowess with languages. Dutch is a particularly awkward one, but he got to know it well when the touring jobs with theatre groups dried up.
When we were seriously out of work, that was when I dug out an address I'd been given by someone along the way in my misspent youth about an English service in Dutch radio where they had four or five people, usually a couple of Americans, a Canadian, and one or two English people, to do a 40-minute transmission three times a day of all manner of things, interviews and commentaries and bits that were... actually, the idea was to sell Holland abroad on shortwave radio. So I wrote to them and they said, yes, we'd like you to do an audition. Go to HMVs in Oxford Street, make a 3-minute acetate, which we've got to deal with them. They'll know all about that. And we want you to read a bit of a news bulletin and do a music programme introduction and anything else you think of and send it to us. So I did. And they said, yes, that's good. You've got the job. Come out. So we went to live in Holland and were in eventually there for 2 years doing just that sort of routine. And that, I have to say, I enjoyed enormously.
I'm standing at the moment actually in the bottom of a tremendous gap in one of the dikes. This morning we drove our truck, or rather we crawled along the slithery surface of the top of the dike, and suddenly we had to stop and couldn't go any further. Stretching out in front of us was a vast expanse of mud and snow and floating debris.
A rare example of Brian's talents as a reporter from Radio Netherlands in 1953. So it was in the Low Countries that Brian became a broadcasting all-rounder. He enjoyed the local jazz too. The Dutch Swing College Band was in its prime.
So while we were doing that, I got another little taste of broadcasting because I wrote to Jack Dabbs at the BBC, said I'd been working in Holland, and I got some sort of inkling of Dutch jazz. So would he like me to do a programme on that for his World of Jazz series? And he took me on, and I did, and it was quite well received.
Eventually, our man found he was in demand everywhere and spoilt for choice.
It got to the stage where I was suddenly offered everything at the same time. On top of the invitation to go back to Holland, another thing I'd applied for was the editorship of a works magazine for Dunlop. They decided to give that to me. And there was something else as well. There were three jobs I could have taken like that. And I had done a BBC audition and heard nothing about it. So we sat tight, and eventually that came up as well, and that was the one we chose. And I didn't do all those other strange offers that wound up at the BBC.
And what is more, in a staff job. So, in the BBC's archive, we meet Brian first as an announcer on the famous comedy series Take It From Here.
Take it from here. Don't go away when you can take it from here. Why don't you stay and maybe join in the fun now the show has begun.
Yes, Dick Bentley and Jimmy Edwards will be on hand for the next 30 minutes with June Whitfield, Wallace Eaton and the Keynotes, all inviting you to...
Take it from here.
As you can hear, the old Vic hadn't quite worn off yet.
Brian was the announcer. I used to love the way the announcer, at the end of the show, gave the closing announcement, a big long announcement, 20, 30 seconds, and then managed to finish exactly at the right spot, saying something like, tune in again next week, and they all sang, take...
Peter Acaster and the BBC Review Orchestra bring our recorded show, The Last in the Present series, to a close. Those involved were Dick Bentley, Professor Jimmy Edwards and June Whitfield, encouraged by Wallace Eaton and the keynotes. Brian Matthew was the announcer, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden wrote the scripts, and the series was produced by Charles Maxwell. We all say au revoir until the next time we invite you to...
How does he do that, I used to think, even, you know, as a 9-10-year-old child?
Brian even participated in one of the most famous comedy intros of them all.
We present Tony Hancock, Bill Kerr, Sidney James, Andre Milley and Kenneth Williams in...
Hancock's Half Hour.
Tony was peculiar, to say the least, and everybody else was quite wonderful. I got very friendly there with Kenneth Williams and also with Sid James. Not with Tony. He'd come in solitary and sit huddled and grumble about the script. Sit there pouring, yeah, that's not funny. Things like, I won't get a laugh with that. So I talked to the two writers about, I said, oh, no, doesn't it worry you when he said, no, he does that every week, but you wait till he gets going with the audience there. We know what'll get a laugh. And of course they did. That was how I began 3 years as a staff announcer. And at that time I thought, well, it seems to me like one ought to be making preparations to get into television. I'd quite like to be a television director, so it would help if I went into production. So I talked to management and they gave me an attachment to the Light programme as a producer, trainee producer, on radio. And I went over there, and when I got there, by this time I'd started introducing Saturday Club. And they said, well, we'd like you to carry on doing that, but doing some production as well.
Saturday Club started as a slightly more specialist programme based on a new style of music that had sprung up in the folk and jazz clubs. Jimmy Grant was the producer who spotted it.
So he submitted an idea of doing Skiffle Club. And he'd encountered me somewhere along the way in my capacity as an announcer. So he asked for me to be the introducer of Skiffle Club, and I didn't even know what Skiffle was in those days, but I soon found out.
We present Saturday Skiffle Club. This is Brian Matthews saying, come right on in. Limping along after a perilous escape from his wild fans, his Johnny Duncan and his Bluegrass Boys.
Oh, now let me be your little salty dog, or I won't be your little man at all. Now, honey, let me be your salty dog.
I was aware of Brian Matthew on the Skiffle Club.
The actor-singer Mark Winter.
I was still at school, but I was a big fan of Donegan and Chas McDevitt and Johnny Duncan, the Bluegrass Boys, all those people. So I was quite aware of that kind of music and loved it, and bought Rock Island Line and did a Freight Train. And worked with some of those people later on, of course, as well. So Brian was already in my frame before I was asked to appear on Saturday Club, and I was thrilled, to say the least, to be able to be on that show with this man who was there from day one.
The production values soon became more ambitious under Brian's direction.
Could we have a little fairground atmosphere, please? Fine, fine, that's splendid. Now, a little fairground music. Grand. Well, now, welcome to a special bank holiday edition of Skiffle Club. Just over here is one of the main attractions. It's our first skiffle group coming in aboard the Big Dipper.
Although although along the way there'd be others who started to appreciate the value of electronic instruments. Horror, shock horror, as far as skiffles were concerned, but nevertheless they started to introduce it and turn themselves into rock bands, or rock and roll bands at least. And anyway, that element came into it. And then manager or director or whatever he was of Light Programme thought, this is a good thing, we can do something about this. So he dreamed up the idea of expanding it to a two-hour programme to cover all areas of popular music, including, initially anyway, a skiffle group, so there was an overlap, as it were, and always a rock and roll band that had evolved from that, a trad band, and then there'd be individual pop singers with little groups of session men, for the most part, making up a two-hour programme.
From that point, Saturday Club was famous.
I'm finding out what love is all about.
Of course, in the days of, you know, like Saturday Club and things, a lot of people didn't have television then, so they listened to the radio all the time. And you know, even at home, you know, I had eight brothers and sisters and things, so we couldn't afford a television. And that was our bag, was the radio.
Craig Douglas, a chart topper of those times. It wasn't long before Brian colonised the weekend completely by devising Easy Beat, a parallel show for Sundays.
My dearest, my darling, tomorrow is near.
Easy Beat, your Sunday best. Which it was, because, I mean, the weekend, for me, and I'm sure millions of other listeners, started with Saturday morning Saturday Club, and then Sunday morning Easy Beat.
That was a live show at the Playhouse Theatre, with 600 people packed into the theatre every week to see all these pop stars for nothing, for goodness sake. And I loved introducing that. We used to do a warm-up that was nearly as long as the show, so that I could get all the... I mean, I couldn't be in the control box. I had to rely on the studio manager getting the balance the way it should have been for all these things, which, of course, by choosing the right people, I could almost guarantee would happen. And then I'd have to get out and chat to the audience, doing a sort of stand-up comic bit, and then introduce the show.
We don't have an Easy Beat warm-up to hand, but one has survived from the Saturday Club archive, an outside broadcast in Blackpool.
Nothing there. Hello, and welcome to Saturday Club. We're glad to see you all here, and we hope you're going to have a ball. There's just a few things we want to explain to you. Actually, this is not a sort of stage show as such, because we've never done it this way before, and we don't want, anywhere along the way, applause, if you wouldn't mind, because this is something that we don't normally do in Saturday Club. It would sound so different, it would throw everybody off their stroke. So no applause anywhere along the line, right till the end of the show when we go off the air, and then if you feel like it after 2 hours, you can. Please, please dance, jive, rave, whatever you do, there's a little bit of room, the whole time. You know, there's no restriction on this, so just enjoy yourselves. We also have with us a bunch of layabouts from around these parts who've now gone out for a quick fix called the Merseysippi Jazz Band. And from the North Pier, we're going to welcome the Allisons. I think they've gone for a cup of coffee. And Johnny Wiltshire and the Treble Tones, also from the same show. You'll see all of those people up here on stage. This is a swinging place. Don't people get up early? I drove along at 7:30 on the promenade. I'm not kidding you, because we've been rehearsing, and there was thousands of people all looking for the sea, I think they were.
He was quite the cheeky chappy on stage. And vocally, I thought there was just a slight resemblance to Tony Hancock, another Midlander. Brian was a solid adult presence in a world of teenagers. Not just the audience, but the artist too. Like Helen Shapiro.
I don't know whether I went up to the West End in my school uniform. Probably not. I wouldn't have been seen dead in such a thing. So I'd put my gear on, my tight skirt and my stilettos and all the rest of it. A bit of slap on the face. Big hair. And go and sing my songs with Brian, with John Barry, with all these people there. And just being part of the crowd, for me, was great. Even though I was invariably the youngest one, I wish I could still say that, I was treated as an equal, and it was just fun doing those programs.
Well, just because I'm in my teens and I still go to school, don't think that I dream childish dreams. I'm
contrasting girl singer resident on Easy Beat was Maureen Evans.
And Maureen proved to be as successful as I always thought she would. I mean, she didn't become the big hit star. I know she had hits, but she was just so good. A really, really good singer, I thought, always did think.
And a good recording partner, too. Brian made a couple of recordings with Maureen, and what's more, he suggested it.
It was my idea that we should do a number together, and I rather like that Peter Sellers, Sophie Loren record of Goodness Gracious Me, so I thought we can do a pretty good impersonation of that. Got a good arrangement of it done, as per the record, and we did it on stage, and the audience went bananas. Now, somebody heard this from Woolworths Records, so they said, we'd like you to come along and record that for our own label. Well, Maureen, in effect, already was in that company because she worked for Oriel, who, as a side issue, made the Woolworths records anyway.
And then one day, the recording manager, Reg Warburton, rang and said, Maureen, we're up to London next week and we'd like you to cover the Sophie Loren and Peter Sellers record. Now, immediately, I had a vision of this stunningly gorgeous Sophie Loren in my mind. And Reg said, he said, I heard this sort of strangled cry at the end of the phone. And I said, don't worry, my love, we want you to try to sound like her. You don't have to try to look like her. But anyway, I was still a bit nervous because I thought, well, the Italian accent and this lovely, sexy sound. Now, Brian Matthew became Matt Bryant, which I can understand. And for some unknown reason, I became Linda Joyce. No one has ever told me why or where that came from. But anyway, it was a fun record and I still play it.
Oh, doctor, I'm in trouble.
Well, goodness gracious me.
For every time...
Well, goodness gracious me.
We did another one later on. We did the Italian Bangers and Mash. But we didn't have any hits. Anyway, we did those two records. And I must say... And I listen to it. It doesn't make me cringe as much as one or two others that I've done.
Brian was still radio's Mr. Weekend when the pop music business suddenly changed, moving into a new gear, as you might say.
Although the bulk of the show was pre-recorded, we did try to have one band live on Saturdays in Studio 3A at Broadcasting House. No longer that. I mean, Broadcasting House is there, but 3A isn't. It was a two-story set up with a control cubicle and my cubicle to do links and announces, then down a flight of stairs to a larger studio where you put the live groups. So I would, when we got to one of their numbers, I had to run down the flight of stairs, introduce them down there, and then belt back up to the other studio for the rest of the programme. And there I met for the first time this astonishing group called the Beatles, who instantly totally took my breath away. I thought, this is the most exciting thing I've heard since I've been doing this funny caper. They are sufficiently different to be really out on their own. What they do, they're doing wonderfully. They were great in the cheeky chat that they made their hallmark, and it remained so for the rest of their practical careers, indeed. And we just hit it off like wildfire from the word go. They like me, apparently. I like them. Epstein was there and he got quite friendly, so it was all very, very healthy.
Before we hear another song, fellas, there are a few things I'd like to ask you. First of all, do you ever get tired of being Beatles?
Sometimes I get a bit lonely now.
No, I don't think so, really.
You don't ever think
no.
That.
Just occasionally you get cheesed off with people often.
Yeah. I agree with that. I've had a divorce and half a dozen kids.
Now, what do you... well, I mean, isn't this a big sort of drag to go around explaining to your wife that you're not divorced and all that?
No, she knows I'm not divorced because I keep seeing her every day, see?
Yeah, there's a point. But what about the simpler things of life, like...
Like riding on a bus.
Yeah, or going to just about any restaurant you can.
Well, yeah, you miss those sort of things.
We go to certain ones.
And we go to ones where the people there are so snobby, they're the type who pretend they don't know us, so we have a good time. Because they're
Joe's
pretending
calf.
They don't know us.
Yeah, that figures.
See,
Joe's calf. Yeah. Social comment, that, you know.
It is.
Well, we're across town, she's good to me. Oh, yeah. Say, I got a woman, we're across town. She's good to me. Oh yeah. She gives me money every time I need. Yes, you know Wicker's town, she's good for me.
Stage where they were going to on their American tour, and Brian rang me and said, would I like to go with them and travel with them in their plane, stay in the same hotel, and have full access for all interview material I wanted. Would I go? And he said, the BBC are quite keen. And I went for a week or just over a week and met them in New York, and then we went up to Canada and then down to Texas and all over the place. And I left them as they were just heading for California, so I didn't get to go there on that trip. But we had them used to see them, of course, after the show every night in the hotel and sit and gab and have coffee quite often and sandwiches, and got to know them really well, and that was maintained for quite a substantial amount of time.
Brian was present at the stadium concert where music was heavily defeated by the noise of the fans.
Well, they took some honey from a tree, dressed it up and they called it.
I remember chatting to, I had a recording of this, which I'm sure exists somewhere. A little boy was standing adjacent to me in the this packed audience. And so I took the opportunity of getting a few words with him and said, who's your favourite? I know it's a stupid, dull old question everybody asks. And he said, oh, John Lennon. I said, why is that? He said, because he has an eloquence without being eloquent. I thought, full marks to you, baby. And that I used as a sort of lead line for quite a long time. I thought it was such a wonderful comment and so true.
Decades went by, but the affection between Brian and the Beatles always remained.
Paul was in to be interviewed by one of my colleagues on Radio 2, saw me and waiting to go into my studio, rushed across, threw his arms round my neck and said, oh, great to see you. Oh, do you remember all those wonderful shows we used to do down at the Playhouse Theatre? He said, let's do it again. And I said, you don't mean it, but it's nice of you to say so. And I think I probably said what all both of you, you know, sadly, it would have to be now.
And they close with another of their film songs, The Things We Said Today.
You say you will love me if I have to go. You'll be thinking of me, somehow I will know. Someday.
The very first week we did this, there were two kids on. There was a chap called Bill Butler, who then became a disc jockey on Liverpool local radio, and there was Janice Nichols, who was a little darling brummy girl with a most mile-wide Birmingham accent. And when it came to marking records, Janice would say, if she really liked a piece, I'll give you five. Now, that became this instant catchword. I mean, I still find taxi drivers who, when they recognise my voice, not that they know who I am, but that they put one and two together and make it five. And they all remember Janice.
If I can think back, there was nobody that actually used regional accents. And I think somehow my black country accent, the public must have liked it. So they asked for me to come back the next week. And I did 2 weeks following. And then I was on for 3 years, 62 to 65. I was pin up of three ships, a fire station, a submarine. Loads of people used to write to me. And when I went to the studio, the kids outside, they'd always give me a pile of autograph books to take in with me, you know, to get signed. And the one time Paul McCartney came to me and he asked me if I wanted a cake. And I said, oh, yes. And he gave me this cake in the shape of a guitar. that one of the fans had biked for him for his birthday. And of course, with them having to rush out, he couldn't carry it, so he gave it me. And I kept that kite for years until it went mouldy. So, you know, it was marvellous memories. Marvellous.
It's a disc that's different. I'll give it 5.
Janis Nichols. I remember those days very well indeed, because at the time I was working on Jukebox Jury, the opposing programme on BBC television, chaired by the much-missed David Jacobs. Brian was the competition, but David respected his ability to communicate with a popular audience and always remained a fan.
It was marvellous to be with him in those times, because not only was he doing Easy Beat and the television programme that was a rival to mine, we were really rivals to each other. But we had a happy relationship. His voice was strong and powerful.
Eventually, Brian and Thank Your Lucky Stars did come to a parting of the ways.
I was taken off by losing my patience with the audience, of having been instructed to do warm-ups in which they were whipped into a frenzy. I found, what am I doing? I can't stand this. These people, they scream at everything on sight. And I mean, it's a bit of a waste of time saying anything to them as a compere, because they're not going to hear it anyway. And so I don't know, but I think I lost my rag, and I told them off on in a programme on one occasion and said, you're behaving like I don't know what, and can't you calm down a bit? And the management quite rightly thought, who does he think he is? And we want him to scream, that's what it's all about.
It was perhaps the first sign that Brian had moved on, just out of range of the youth market. The 60s were a turbulent time in broadcasting, and more than one rupture of that kind happened to Brian in those years. Saturday Club also came to an end.
I did it for 9 years, I think, and then some man in his wisdom decided that he didn't want me anymore. And it was when it transferred to Radio 1, and he didn't want me on Radio 1. I was, on the face of it, out of work, when a producer named Brian Willey, who produced a daily programme called Roundabout, said he was shocked and horrified at what they'd done to me and would I like to go and work for him.
But the most painful sundering came on Easy Beat, when Brian was asked to nominate a new producer for the show.
A guy had worked with me as a sound balancer for a very long time, and on Saturday Club as well, and was regularly with me on Easy Beat. And I thought, he'd be ideal. He's a good balancer and he knows his music and so on. So I suggested him, and he got the job. And the next week, he fired me. Unbelievably. I mean, I could not believe what happened. I was just flabbergasted when he did that. But on the other hand, it didn't really matter. There was still plenty of work.
That strange event was part of Brian's transition from pure pop to the all-round arts and culture scene, which he'd always been well qualified to survey. The pop theme did linger for a good long while, so that the BBC archive is full of Brian's excellent interviews with visiting stars, some of them reluctant to talk elsewhere. Dusty Springfield was one of the shyest.
Dusty, I don't know whether people all know as much as most of us here know, that in fact you were really one of the O'Briens, right?
Oh, yes, that's right. It is.
How Irish are you?
Well, furiously sometimes when I feel it's to my advantage, you know, when people are saying nice things about the Irish. I'm very Irish when it comes to music. I love Irish music. I think that basically they're the most musical people in these particular islands, even though they don't belong to the British Isles as such. Mm. I'm Irish when it comes to laziness and a certain amount of temper.
Ah,
and Irish in certain sort of whimsy.
Yeah.
I laugh at some things I think that Irish people only would laugh at. Mm-hmm.
It took a while, but finally a proper Radio 2 showcase for Brian's versatility was found.
It was initially supposed to have been introduced by two people, and this was a programme called Round Midnight, to be on air from 11 at night till 1 o'clock the following morning, 2 o'clock the following morning. Yes, it was a 3-hour show. And they asked me to be one of the compares, and initially they had a lady in mind to do a dual presentation. And I'm afraid I spat that one out because it wasn't a lady that I particularly wanted to work with. I mean, she's okay, but I didn't see myself as part of that circus. And so I said, no, I'll gladly do it, but not with that partnership. I would like to do it on my own.
Brian always did know his own mind. And so Round Midnight began under his sole proprietorship in 1978.
In those days, there was a rule on Radio 2 that regular presenters had to take, I think it was a three-week holiday from the airwaves, and be substituted for by somebody else. I suppose it was a way of finding out who else was capable of what.
Russell Davis.
So I was Brian's deputy at a certain stage, and I have to tell you that Round Midnight was the hardest work I have ever done in broadcasting. It was all day, every day. You had to read a book most days, if not two books, bank some recorded interviews in the afternoon, maybe see an exhibition or something, and listen to somebody's album, and then you came in and you helped prepare a running order. And finally, when you were already knackered, you went on air late at night, live, for this long show, including some live interviews with, for example, actors coming straight off stage in the West End, arriving in the studio with their makeup still on. It was very exciting, but by the end of the week, it had you completely wiped out. I have no idea how Brian kept it up for a dozen years, was it?
Well, I loved it. It was so demanding. It's not just I'm not frightened of hours of the day being utilised, but it was day and night.
Here's a typical Round Midnight event. Peter Ustinov dropping in to discuss his latest work of fiction.
I agree with my protagonist in that I think the mania for privatization at the moment is excessive.
Yes.
I don't think any society can be healthy if the only yardstick is market value. I think it's really very unhealthy, and I think it leads to terrible complications later on. I think that privatization, as far as the arts are concerned also, is not a liberating force at all. On the contrary, I think it leads to a new kind of series of dominations by forces which are much more difficult to control than a neutral state organization, which has, in point of fact, hasn't the mechanism to make up its mind quickly about certain things.
I'm glad to hear you say that in a BBC studio, because for goodness sake, if we ever chuck away whatever we have here in the BBC, I think it'd be a sad day.
I absolutely agree 1,000%, and that was one of the points of view I had when they decided in my book to start a partial privatization of the Royal Navy. And a biscuit company decides that it's willing to underwrite a frigate on condition the frigate carries the name of the biscuit company. I think that's what we're heading for.
Yes.
And I think it's, on the whole, absolutely atrocious. And the way back from there is going to be very painful.
Round Midnight was a brilliant show, and sadly, when Round Midnight came to an end, I was the man who was put in to replace it. It wasn't my choice. I didn't want to leave my nice spot at 9:30 in the morning, but it, you know, the BBC has a way of persuading you to do these things, like do it or get sacked. So I had to go to night time, and I was the new show that precipitated the end of Round Midnight. As we know, presenters rarely turn on each other. We all suffer the same slings and arrows. But we just accept that somebody else gets the job. And Brian was absolutely charming to me. I didn't want to go to that slot, as I said. And Brian, I'm sure, didn't want to leave it. But as it turned out, it wasn't bad for him, because he went pretty well straight into Sounds of the 60s. And that is the biggest single show on Radio 2 every week, and always has been.
I was contacted by, I guess it would have been Frances Lyon, or certainly one of her spokespersons, saying that they were sorry I was going to be removed from Round Midnight, but would I care to introduce Sound of the 60s? Now, as it happens, when Sound of the 60s was first introduced, I was the person that the inventor of it had suggested as being the compere from the word go. But the gent who was then one of the management team of Light Programme, Steve Allen, who was an old friend of mine, he called me in and he said, "You don't want to do that now, do you?" He said, "You're giving up all this DJ lark now. You're a no sort of posh interviewer bloke, and you don't want to do Sound of the 60s.
Well, at first, Brian allowed himself to be persuaded that he didn't want to do it. but at the second time of asking, he seized the opportunity with enthusiasm, and the result was that the show carried him through to the end of his days. He earned the biggest audience for single shows in all of Radio 2, and since Radio 2 is the most popular station in the kingdom, that made Brian the monarch of all he surveyed. And he did it, he and his producer Phil Swern, not by playing wall-to-wall hits, but by expertly and lovingly sifting through the rarities of his chosen decade.
Now, poor dear old Francis Lyne had once said, "I don't like all this unfamiliar material you're putting in. I want number ones." I said, "Oh, come on, Francis. How long is that going to last? 3 months, you know, and you played everything. Then you're going to be repeating everything." So we went along with it. Because I introduced a number one feature with three number ones somewhere in the show, and that kept her quiet for a bit. Good morning, Avids. We'll begin this week with a hit by Motown star Marvin Gaye. In 1969, he scored an international number one with I Heard It Through the Grapevine, which had been written by Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong. He followed it up the same year with another of Whitfield's compositions that reached number five here, Too Busy Thinking About My Baby.
The sounds of the 60s. Whose audience, of course, included the sound makers themselves.
And can you believe it? One morning we're sitting there and Brian happened to play one of my records. Well, I tell you what, my brownie points went scoring really high that morning.
Of course, we live in a much more aggressive world today, but Brian has never changed his style. And his style is, it's, I would say, quintessentially English, British. And his voice, as we know, is that... It's that rather sort of honey-coated, slightly gritty sound, which is so appealing, you know? You couldn't replace it, and you couldn't mistake it. He, to me, is the voice that represents the 60s pop music on BBC Radio, bar none.
So thank you very much, Brian, for keeping the music alive. That's not just for me, but it's on behalf of everybody that sang and recorded songs in the 60s.
So said John Layton, Mark Winter and Maureen Evans, who were there when it was all new. I was there too, and what I say is that if there were more broadcasters who were as microphone savvy and people friendly as Brian Matthew was, we'd all be in a better place.
Brian, lovely man, warm, warm broadcaster.
Ken Bruce.
And you felt, as you were listening to him, my friend.
As a former Radio 2 controller says...
The Brian Matthew sound is, for me, forever associated with Saturday mornings. There's something about the richness, the velvety tones of Brian Matthew and the calm, warm authority in the way that he spoke that just was the perfect fit for that feeling of the beginning of the weekend and listening to sounds of the 60s. It's like the genuine soundtrack to everybody's lives on a Saturday morning.
Bob Shannon, now director of BBC Radio. Only one thing bothers me. I did mention Brian's prowess with languages. We haven't actually demonstrated his command of the European scene. But we can put that right with the aid of a superb recording he once made with his disc jockeying colleague Pete Murray. I leave you with their hands.
Ah, monsieur, voudrez-vous danser avec moi?
I beg your pardon?
Voudrez-vous danser avec moi?
Eh, what's it all about, then?
Would you like to dance with me?
I'm Jim Moyer, and the Brian Matthew story was a Ping production for Radio 2, written by Russell Davis and produced by Graham Pass.
Oh, quand tu es la plus belle jeune fille que j'ai jamais vue.
Here, just a minute, what are you saying then?
This is BBC Radio 2, online, on digital radio, and on 88 to 91 FM.
BBC News at 8 o'clock. This is Claire Runacres. The United States has indicated that China will support an international consensus to deal with North Korea, which wants to build a nuclear weapon that can strike America. China is the communist state's closest ally. President Trump has sent a naval task force to the region.